Hello there. Today is Monday, February 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the gun debate rages on in the United States. Despite a resolution by the UN for a ceasefire, fresh airstrikes in Syria claim more civilian lives.
They are living in constant fear, and they're worried that the next bomb might hit their home and kill their family.
Also ahead, the Black Panther continues to shatter records at U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, after days of diplomatic wrangling, the UN Security Council Saturday adopted a resolution calling for a 30-day ceasefire in Syria without delay to allow for aid deliveries and medical evacuations. The UN resolution raised hopes of stemming the bloodshed, but it remains unclear when or how broadly the ceasefire could be implemented. Stephen Hickey is a British diplomat at the UN.
This is not a moment for self-congratulation. It's taken us far too long to agree this resolution. While we have been arguing over commas, Assad's planes have been killing more civilians in their homes and in their hospitals, imposing unbearable suffering.
And despite a drop in intensity, shelling in the bombardment in Syrian capital and its embattled eastern suburbs left more casualties, with the death toll from more than a week of clashes above 500. As residents attempted to hide from constant airstrikes and artillery bombardment, International Rescue Committee spokesman Paul Donahoe.
There have been reports that the bombardments have continued. I know, speaking to colleagues inside Eastern Ghouta, that they are living in constant fear and they're worried that the next bomb might hit their home and kill their family.
Donahoe said to make matters worse, the wounded may not have a way to get care.
People are in a medical emergency right now. We know that, unfortunately, more than a dozen hospitals seem to have been hit in the last week and put out of action. And you can just imagine the consequence of that for people who have been injured who are not able to receive medical treatment.
Russia is a key ally of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime. In a phone call on Sunday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron urged Russian President Vladimir Putin to use his influence to reach a truce. VOA's Victor Beatty discussed the ongoing tragedy with David Lesh, professor of history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, asking what could be the end game.
The Syrian government is hell-bent on taking back Eastern Ghouta, breaking the resistance there. It's very much key to establishing control, especially in a suburb so close to Damascus. And after this, if they do take Eastern Ghouta, the only remaining opposition enclave would be Idlib, and they would probably move on that next. The ceasefire, like all the other ceasefires in the Syrian civil war, will not be fully implemented. And even if by some miracle it is, it will break down soon thereafter. And particularly in such a chaotic military environment as that which exists in Eastern Ghouta, you know, one side is going to fire on the other, and they can claim that the enemy broke the ceasefire and thus it's null and void. And then, as typically happens, the violence begins again. So I don't have much hope for this. I think it's important to realize that, you know, the one party that is not a signatory to this UN ceasefire and hasn't at least publicly agreed to it to implement it in full is the Syrian government itself. And they're the primary instigator in this. And they're the ones that are going to have to hold their fire. And I'm not sure they're going to, certainly in the short or long term.
Are the Russians key to this, pressuring their ally Damascus to end the combat?
There was a lot of pressure on Russia to do just that, to try to pressure the Syrian government to cease and desist. But Russia has much less influence in Damascus than most people think. Yes, they do have influence because of what they've meant in terms of saving the regime with their military intervention over the last 2.5 years. But in my mind, the Syrian government acts much more independently than most people think. And as of now, certainly their other primary ally, Iran, has much more influence with the Syrian government than with President Bashar al-Assad than the Russian government has. And the Iranian objectives, as well as the Syrian government's objectives in terms of trying to regain as much as possible control over the rest of the country, are aligned, much more so than I think Russian and Syrian government objectives.
Eastern Ghouta has been besieged, as you know, since 2013. Who are the rebels who are basically holding this?
It's a conglomerate of rebels from remnants of the Free Syrian Army to various Islamist groups and just local militias who are trying to protect their neighborhoods. They've come together at times, but they obviously have put up a stiff resistance, and it's a very densely packed area that the Syrian government, which really lacks the resources to go house to house to retake certainly city-type environments, densely packed environments. This is why they're resorting to, you know, bombardment from the outside, from the air, using artillery and allegedly chemical weapons.
There are reports that several people, perhaps one death, have suffered symptoms consistent with exposure to chlorine gas in the Ghouta district near Damascus. One child reportedly killed, according to health authorities in the opposition-held areas. Will anybody be held account war crimes when this conflict is finally over?
It is such a confusing military environment, and apparently, you know, many sides to this conflict have been accused of using chemical weapons or weapons that are lined with chlorine gas or something like that. Certainly the Syrian government has been the most accused. But, you know, as I've long said in this war, it's not only a war on the ground in terms of people shooting at each other, but it's an information war. So it's very, very difficult to get accurate information on who is using what. But hopefully at some point the hammer will fall on those that have used chemical weapons, and hopefully independent investigators will be able to determine who is actually responsible.
Turkey on Sunday welcomed the unanimous demand by the Security Council for the 30-day ceasefire, but insisted that its own operation against the Kurds in northwest Afrin region is not impacted. How is that offensive going?
Well, the Turks, they're facing stiffer resistance. I think most people expected they would face stiff resistance. Their operation last year, Operation Euphrates Shield, was less than impressive in moving against Kurdish and rebel and Islamic State forces in the area, you know, somewhat similar to where they are now. So I think, you know, the slow going progress by the Turkish army is to be expected. The Syrian government apparently has allowed and helped Kurdish fighters from one area move to another area to better resist Turkish advance. So this could get very, very messy. And Russia is kind of in the middle of all this and may have to intervene at some point just to protect its client in Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, if in fact the Turks believe the Syrian government is aiding the Kurds and may take action against the Syrian government itself.
That's David Lash, professor of history at Trinity University in San Antonio. U.S. President Donald Trump repeated his call to arm some teachers in the wake of the recent high school shooting in Florida. Trump spoke before a conservative group near Washington. He's the latest in a series of U.S. presidents forced to deal with the impact of a mass shooting in a school and with the question of what can be done to prevent it. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports that presidents have often been frustrated in the past trying to bridge the great divide over guns in the United States.
President Trump got a warm reception from conservatives meeting near Washington Friday and sought to build support for a controversial idea to arm some teachers to prevent future school shootings.
I want to stop it. And I know it's a little controversial to say, but I have to say, since I started this 2 days ago, a lot of people that were totally opposed to it are now agreeing. They love their students. They don't want their students to be killed and to be hurt.
In the aftermath of the Florida high school shooting, Trump faces pressure to act, much as his predecessors did in the wake of similar national tragedies.
I can only say tonight that the prayers of the American people are with you.
President Bill Clinton spoke to the nation in the wake of the 1999 mass shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado. President George W. Bush offered comfort and prayers following the Virginia Tech massacre in 2007. and an emotional President Barack Obama spoke to the nation after the mass shooting of elementary school students in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012.
We've endured too many of these tragedies in the past few years. The majority of those who died today were children. Beautiful little kids between the ages of 5 and 10 years old.
This week, President Trump heard from students and parents in the wake of the Valentine's Day school shooting in Parkland, Florida, including surviving student Samuel Zeif.
I lost a best friend, who's practically a brother. And I'm here to use my voice because I know he can't.
Recent polls show a jump in support for additional gun restrictions, says Quinnipiac pollster Tim Malloy.
If you think Americans are not paying attention or moved by these shootings, you're wrong. In the last 2 years, we've seen a 20% jump in calls for stricter gun control.
But support in the polls does not always translate into votes come election time, says analyst Capri Cafaro.
NRA members are very reliable voters. So just because public opinion polls say people want background checks, that doesn't necessarily translate to people showing up at the polls.
Students have taken to the streets demanding action in the wake of the Florida tragedy, and that could have a lasting political impact, says Malloy.
These young voices have jumped out in the last 4 or 5 days and appear to be at the tip of the spear of a movement. So the sense is a movement that had started has now gained momentum and accelerating, and we may see some change out of this.
The first opportunity to demonstrate change will come in this November's midterm congressional elections. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Nigeria is confirming 110 girls missing now after a Boko Haram attack. New fighting erupts near Damascus despite the UN ceasefire. Trump spars with the key Democrat over surveillance memos. And thousands commemorate the murdered Russian opposition leader ahead of elections. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And turning now to the growing threat of cybersecurity in the United States and around the world, a big security conference was held in Munich, and the takeaway was a list of recommendations that encourage governments to use strong encryption while creating a legal framework for authorized law enforcement to actually have access to plain text of encrypted data in limited cases. Joining us now to talk about it is the East West Institute Global Vice President Bruce McConnell. Thank you for being with us. So what's the problem that this report actually is trying to solve?
Well, you summarized it very well. Cybersecurity is an increasing concern for people everywhere. Attacks are becoming more dangerous. We've seen the power grids attacked in the Ukraine, hospitals attacked in Great Britain, and intellectual property stolen in the United States. Encryption protects digital information so that it can't be read or changed by an unauthorized person. So strong encryption is an important tool to protect business information, personal data, and privacy and other human rights. At the same time, criminals are increasingly using cyber tools to plan and implement crimes. Terrorists are recruiting adherents and plotting their attacks. When these bad actors use encryption, it reduces the ability of law enforcement to protect the public. So law enforcement is asking for ways to access the plain text of encrypted information under certain circumstances. The report is trying to find a balance point among all these values: public safety and security, cybersecurity, commerce, and human rights.
And some of the suggestions include all of those elements, I take it?
Right. We tried to find a balanced approach which gave something to everybody. So the first recommendation is about strong cybersecurity, and the governments need to support and enable strong cybersecurity throughout the digital ecosystem. At the same time, in certain circumstances, it may be important for law enforcement to be able to get a hold of data that has been encrypted, as long as it's done in a transparent way through due process and independent judicial review.
How did you come up with the recommended approach?
Well, we started by developing an analytical methodology, really, to take all these interests into account, and then we applied the methodology using a broad range of international experts from the U.S., Europe, and India, and representing all the interests. So the result of those deliberations, which took place over a four-month period, is the recommendations in the report, but none of the participants necessarily agree with all the recommendations. We had to balance a variety of competing viewpoints. So we hope that governments will consider using our methodology as they develop national encryption policies.
And why did the report focus on democratic governments?
We call it encryption policy in democratic regimes because in democratic regimes, you have to balance public safety and security and human rights and privacy more than you have to do so in authoritarian regimes. So we have East-West has a global network. We talk to people in authoritarian regimes all the time about some security issues, including cybersecurity, but it didn't seem appropriate in this particular case to do that with encryption.
Would these recommendations also apply to, say, Russia's interference in U.S. politics?
So in the case of the Russian interference, there were two parts. There were Russian actors who stole emails from the Democratic National Committee. In that, those kinds of emails would have been protected if the users had encrypted them, and so that would have made them less worthwhile for the Russian actors to have stolen them. That's on the one hand. The aspect of attempting to influence the elections through fake news and other bots and everything is not something that encryption directly gets at. However, there could be situations where actors who were doing those things encrypted their information, their planning, etc. And if in the investigative part where, for example, Mr. Mueller was trying to figure out what they were doing and if it was encrypted, he couldn't get to it, then the recommendations in our report might provide him with the ability to understand what was really going on in those communications.
And what kinds of reactions has the report generated?
Well, I think both sides of this debate, the technology side who believe that strong cybersecurity is the most important thing there is, and the law enforcement side who thinks that law enforcement is the most important thing there is, are dissatisfied because neither got in the report everything that they want. So it attempts to make a compromise. And so we are hearing from both sides that the report doesn't fairly represent the importance of their views. So that's, for us, a good thing. It shows we're somewhere in the middle.
All right. That's East-West Institute Global Vice President Bruce McConnell. Thanks for being with us. Well, only days after the spectacular liftoff of what's currently the heaviest space rocket in use, the privately built Falcon Heavy, NASA announced the next launch will carry a specially built atomic clock. The new device is much smaller and sturdier than the Earth-bound atomic clocks, which help astronauts navigate in deep space. VOA's George Pudyk reports.
Even SpaceX CEO Elon Musk was not sure the Falcon Heavy's first flight would go as smoothly as it did.
I didn't really think this would work. When I see the rocket lift off, I see like 1,000 things that could not work, and it's amazing when they do.
The Falcon Heavy's 27 rocket engines can carry as much as 64 tons of payload way beyond the low Earth orbit, where the International Space Station and most satellites circle our planet. Its next launch is scheduled for June, and it is not yet known what its payload will be, except for one piece of cutting-edge technology, the new deep space atomic clock built by NASA. It is now undergoing tests at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. John Lowe is a scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which also builds atomic clocks.
Time is distance. And so if you have an atomic clock in space, it's an aid to your navigational process. And so the better the clock, the better you can use it for your navigation.
According to NASA, the deep space atomic clock is expected to lose not more than 7 millionths of a second during a decade. Smaller than a microwave oven, it is specially built for harsh space environment. Earthbound atomic clocks precisely measure how long it takes for a radio signal to travel between the Earth and the spacecraft. This allows ground controllers to tell astronauts where they are and where to go next. An atomic clock positioned closer to their spaceship will help astronauts navigate without having to wait for signals from the Earth.
I think pretty much every deep space mission will probably have an atomic clock on it from here on out.
NASA engineers say in the future they will build even smaller space atomic clocks that could also help improve the satellite-based global positioning system. George Putich, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Academy Award-winning actress Jennifer Lawrence stars in a new spy thriller, Red Sparrow. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, Lawrence plays a specially trained Russian spy who finds her loyalties divided on her first assignment.
When I was in Moscow, I heard about a program. Young officers trained to seduce and manipulate. Call them sparrows. That's what she is.
Jennifer Lawrence plays Russian spy Dominika Igorova, who is trained as a sparrow to use seductive techniques in order to gain trust. The actress often appears nude and is in several scenes of physical and sexual abuse in the film. But she said at the European premiere, the movie is the right film at the right time, even in the wake of recent sexual abuse and harassment scandals in Hollywood.
I think it's the perfect movie that we need right now. I think that this is a woman who's been controlled and manipulated her entire life, and she takes back control, and she's empowered. I felt empowered even just filming it. So I think that it's going to be, I think it's a perfect film for right now, for women.
Australian actor Joel Edgerton plays Nate Nash, Dominika's first target, and a CIA officer who handles the most sensitive infiltration of Russian intelligence. He says the film shows a woman taking control of her own destiny.
Well, it's kind of an incredible story of a girl who's been, like, you know, pushed into shapes by the men in her life and abused by the men in her life and put into this, you know, crazy program in the context of the movie, but manages to kind of, you know, store all that information as fuel for vengeance and gets back at all these people and cuts them off at the knees, and I think it's pretty awesome.
Director Francis Lawrence, who directed Jennifer Lawrence in the Hunger Games trilogy, says he let the 27-year-old actress have the final say on what scenes were included in the movie.
I had to be really upfront because she had never done anything like this, that, you know, what to expect on the day, how we can be as respectful as possible, how we can keep it as private as possible. I promised I would show her the movie before anybody, including the studio or producers, so she always had the right of refusal on anything that was in it. So I just tried to give her as much information as possible, make her as comfortable as possible, and give her as much control as possible going into that situation.
Red Sparrow also stars Matthias Schoenaerts, Oscar nominee Charlotte Rampling, and Oscar winner Jeremy Irons. It is rated R for strong violence, torture, sexual content, language, and graphic nudity.
In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
I have seen gods fly. I've seen men build weapons that I couldn't even imagine.
Uh-huh.
I've seen aliens drop from the sky.
Yeah.
But I have never seen anything like
this. Disney's Black Panther sunk its claws into the top spot again this weekend at the North American box office, taking an estimated $108 million, according to industry estimates Sunday. Following a record-shattering opening weekend, raking in $242.2 million, the frenzy to see the 18th entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe continued, bringing total earnings to an astronomical $400 million in just 4 days. Well, its global take is now more than $700 million. The film is yet to open in China or Japan, and it's only the fourth movie ever to make more than $100 million in its second weekend, joining Star Wars, The Force Awakens, Jurassic World, and Marvel's Avengers, according to Disney, which owns Marvel Studios. It's directed by Ryan Coogler. Black Panther features an almost entirely black cast, led by Chadwick Boseman as the first non-white superhero to get his own standalone movie in the franchise. He plays a superhero also known as T'Challa, king and protector of Wakanda, a technologically advanced, affluent, never-colonized utopia in Africa. And that does it for today's show. We appreciate your listening to International Edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Joan Cummings. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently launched two new projects, the Business Ecosystem Project and Factoring Project, that will support micro, small, and medium enterprises access diversified sources of finance in Macedonia. The Business Ecosystem Project is a 4-year activity that will endeavor to transform the competitiveness of micro, small, and medium enterprises in Macedonia by strengthening business services, finance, and market linkages to catalytically increase their growth, productivity, and generation of employment. The project will work with traditional and alternative financial instruments and with micro, small, and medium enterprises to ensure appropriate sources of financing are available and accessible for their business expansion. The Factoring Project is a 3-year activity that will support small and medium enterprises by educating and informing them about alternative access to financial options. Factoring supports the growth of companies by providing quick access to finance and accelerating the flow of cash needed by companies so they can grow more efficiently. The difficulty with accessing finance is among the most commonly cited obstacles to business expansion in the country, especially for micro, small, and medium enterprises, said Director of the Office of Development, Edward Gonzalez. That is why, in its 25 years in Macedonia, USAID has consistently included an access to finance component in its economic development projects. We have always believed that access to different kinds of finance specifically tailored to micro, small, and medium enterprises is an extremely important element in their development. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Macedonia, to foster and develop the amazing economic potential of the people of Macedonia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.